This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Several generations of children have grown up on the books of artist Maurice Sendak, such as Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. He's won the top awards for children's books, but his work has quite an adult following, too. Sendak has also designed sets for several operas. His work for children has always had a dark edge, but nothing quite like his latest work. It's a collaboration with writer Tony Kushner, who's best known for his play Angels in America. They've adapted a children's opera that was originally performed by children in the Nazi concentration camp Terezin. The opera Brundibar is a parable about evil that was written in 1938 by a composer who was killed in the gas chambers. Here's the opening scene from a 1992 recording of Brundibar by the Dysman Radio Children's Ensemble in Prague. A new staging of Tony Kushner and Maurice Sendak's Brundibar premieres Sunday in New York. Terry spoke to Sendak in 2003, when the English adaptation with Kushner's libretto and Sendak's sets was performed in Chicago, and their book adaptation had just been published. Terry asked Sendak why the children in the Nazi concentration camp performed the opera Brundibar.
This opera was written by Hans Krause, a very young Czech composer, and it was written for children, Jewish children, in an orphan asylum in Prague to amuse them. It was a contest who could write the prettiest opera for the children. And Krause wrote this, and everybody loved it. And at that very same point, the Nazis entered the country, and the orphanage was emptied, and the children were put into Terezin, the camp. And he was too, as was the librettist. And it became a show camp, became known as Hitler's favorite camp. He set it up in such a way and made a film of how well the Jews were being treated, and the gypsies, and the homosexuals. And this was too, because rumors were getting out that were frightful. And so he set this up to prove to the Red Cross and diplomats who were traveling the world to come by, see a show, and see how happy everybody was. And it's in the film. You see the children singing the last portion of the opera. So they all sat there. It was performed 55 times, a huge success, this little opera, which is about 45 minutes in length. That's the story. Hans Krause was murdered, too, as was the librettist, as was, well, mostly everybody in the camp. It was an elitist camp. You had Bauhaus workers there. You had artists, people teaching the children there, intellects. It was a special camp. But it ended the same way for all of them.
So the performances were for visiting diplomats to show off the camp.
Yeah.
Do you know if they fell for it?
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely they fell for it. The streets were cleaned, trees were planted, all the children were given clean clothes, all the inmates were given clean clothes. everything was swept up, and they went and you had a pass. Quite an attractive pass, which I'd love to have an original of, but I've used as an image in the book, to get in to see Brundibar.
Tell us the story that's told in the opera that you tell in the book.
This was directly written for children and the limitations of children. They don't have singing voices. Some of them do, but that was by accident. But mostly it's sort of like a Singspiel, which is like a Mozart opera, it's a Singspiel, where you talk over the music rather than actually sing. And those who could sing, sang. And the music is astonishing. He was in his 30s, so you hear Janáček, and you hear Weill, and you hear Gershwin, and you hear Ravel. And just like all of us young artists steal like crazy until we make ourselves up as artists, you hear all these wonderful sounds. And the story is ultra simple, so the children could follow it and produce the tale, which has to do with a little brother and sister whose mother is ill. And the doctor says unless they get milk for her, she won't last. So they go out into the world, which is, in my case, Prague, into the city proper, and please somebody give them money to buy milk for mommy, and nobody will. And in the streets of Prague, on a specific corner, is Brundibar, who is an organ grinder. Mean. In Czech, Brundibar means bee, like a bee sting. And he's taken over the whole place, and he sings, and people throw money in his hat, and the kids say, well, anybody can do that. So they stand on the other corner, and they sing a dreadful song. Everyone just ignores them, and they wonder why they can't do this, and they stay all night in the street by themselves, and a cat and a bird and a dog come to their assistance and say, look, let's pull this together, because the two of you can't do this by yourselves. Let's get all the kids in town. And in the morning, there's this beautiful music. As children wake up, and they're getting ready to go to school and comb their hair and wash dishes and such. And the animals convince them to come and help these kids. So they all come to the town square, 300 of them. And they say to Brundibar, we want to sing, and we don't care about money. We just want to sing. And Brundibar says, no, get the hell out of here. And then the townspeople say, let the kids do it. And they sing a lullaby, which is like extraordinary to hear it. And people are captivated, and they fill their milk can with coins. They've made it. They have enough money now. But Brundibar sneaks in, grabs the can, rushes off and steals their money. And the whole town chases Brundibar, and they catch him, and they beat him up, and the kids get their money back and buy the milk, come home triumphant, and save their mama. And that's the story.
But there's an epilogue to the story. There's a little poem at the end. Could you read that
for
us?
Sure.
And just, you know, reminder, this is written while Hitler is coming to power.
Exactly. And the fact that it is impossible for me to doubt that the children knew what their fate was. Imagine standing up on the stage and singing about brotherhood, and if we all hang together, we're going to succeed, and the bully will not. And knowing that as soon as this audience left, kaput, their lives are finished. I can't even grasp that now. I've been studying, working on this for over 3 years. So in this, I wanted my cake and eat it too, because they do save their mother. But evil will persist as the world goes on, and they have to know that, whether their parents like them to know it or not. Okay, so we're just turning the page on the big happy ending where everything is wonderful and safe and mommy is alive. And then there's a little coda at the end, which was written by Tony, basically. It's not in the opera. And it says, this is Brundibar talking. They believe they've won the fight. They believe I'm gone. Not quite. Nothing ever works out neatly. Bullies don't give up completely. One departs, the next appears, and we shall meet again, my dears. Though I go, I won't go far. I'll be back. Love, Brundibar.
Yeah, it's kind of chilling.
Yeah, kind of chilling.
Chilling epilogue.
Yeah.
So Tony Kushner wrote that for the book.
Yeah.
How do you think the paintings and drawings that you did for the new book, which is a kind of Holocaust fairy tale, mm-hmm. how do those compare with the classic books that you did, like Where the Wild Things Are and Outside Over There?
This is strange to say, more personal. where the wild things are and outside over there. And
in the night kitchen?
Yeah, the night kitchen are all books that came from my original creative soul, self, whatever, that have no conscious connection to events in my life. This, which is, takes the form almost of a grim fairy tale, actually. It's a little Hansel and Gretel story over and over and over again. All those stories work for children. But this had such personal import. I've been carrying this around since childhood and, frankly, wanting to rid myself of it, the Holocaust, and memories of childhood and my parents suffering and no childhood. There was no such thing as childhood, you know. I think mostly the point of the marriage of my mother and father was that you had to have a partnership. If you're a young immigrant who spoke no English, who'd just come over on the boat, and you got together as two partners, whether love was involved in it, maybe if you were lucky, maybe not, but the point was to pool your money and bring everybody over as fast as you can, because most of them knew what was going on and what was about to happen. So it began with my mother's family, and she got her mother, and she got two sisters and a brother, missing the same amount of sisters and brothers that she never got over. My father got no one, because by the time they got to my father, it was way too late to get anybody.
I think you were in high school during World War II.
Yes.
What was the first you actually heard of the death camps?
Early, because my father belonged to it's called the Lobzer Branch. It was like a union. And this union kept track of what was going on in Europe to the various villages and townships. They got their information. I have no idea how. And they kept my father and his buddies informed as to what was going on in their township. And they presented him after the war with a book, which I treasure, of all the villages that were destroyed and the names of the people in the villages. And his village was in the book, and photographs of the town square and the death of his whole family. And that would have been before my bar mitzvah. I would have been between 10 and 12 when I knew what was going on, and unhappily reminded endlessly of my good fortune. And if I came up late for dinner, my mother howling from the window, and I'd be hear about Leo and Benjamin and the other children who were my age who could never come up for supper and were good to their mothers, but now they were dead, and I was lucky. And
oh, yeah. Rule out any pleasure in your life, huh?
You were in mourning all the time.
Right.
And the sad thing is that when you're a kid, your natural impulse is not to be mourning and have fun. I hated them. I hated them because they blighted my life.
We hated who?
I hated them for dying.
Right.
Because all I brought was violent scenes in the house between my mother and father, and her pulling hair out of her head, my father diving onto the bed, and these vivid memories.
Maurice Sendak speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2003 interview with children's book author and illustrator Maurice Sendak.
What were the stories or the fairy tales that had the biggest effect on you when you were young?
My father's stories. My father's a great storyteller.
Did he tell you stories about his life or
yes.
fairy tales his and classic stories?
No, not fairy tales. I mean, he told memory stories, which they call me the dark man of children's. I guess I got it from him, but he would tell us stories that would put us to sleep. My sister, brother, and I shared the same room, and he would sit cross-legged on the floor or bring a chair in, and he would tell us shtetl stories. I mean, stories. You want an example of?
Sure.
Of why I have been an insomniac all my life. here's a story, which was one of my favorites. I wanted to hear it over and over again, how the children of his shtetl got together. And there was a contest, just the boys, of who could run furthest into the cemetery in the middle of the night. And how do you prove that you ran furthest? Because you had a stick, and you put the stick down. And the morning you found out whose stick had gone furthest. And, well, he was doing this with his friend, and they all ran a certain distance, and they couldn't see each other. And he heard this horrible screaming from one of his friends. Horrible screaming. And instead of going to help him, they all ran home. And in the morning, they found him dead. And what he had done, because they wore these long shifts, he put the stick in and it went through his own shift. And it went in the ground and he thought the dead man was pulling him in. Because his screams were all to do, the dead man is taking me, the dead man is taking me. And they thought he was just hysterical. But he thought somebody had reached in and was pulling him into the grave.
Huh.
That was one of his stories. My favorite, actually.
Gosh. And then they can't reassure you and say, but honey, it's just a story.
No.
Because it was true.
Because it happened.
Right.
Because it happened. I'd much rather have known that it happened. I was in the unfortunate position of causing a child's death when I was a child.
What happened?
And we lived in Brooklyn, and there were these big, ugly houses, and there were these narrow alleys between each apartment house where we played ball, where the clotheslines hung. And I was playing with Lloydie. How could I forget his name? His name was Lloyd, but we called him Lloydie. And we were throwing a ball to each other, and I was at the far end, and he was facing the street. And I had this ball, and I threw it very hard, and it went over his head, and it ran into the street, and he chased it. And next I saw him flying, hit by a car. He was killed.
Oh.
And I ran home, and I stayed in the house. And I thought I'd never come out of the house because his mother would kill me. And how could I ever go on living? And my mother was very worried, and because I would not go out of the house. And I don't know how it all came about, but they worked it out that I was come down into the street and sit on the stoop, and Lloydie's mother and his little sister would come and talk to me. And I wouldn't go down unless she would forgive me somehow. And I remember sitting on the stoop. I must have been 6, 7, something like that. And I still see her face and his little sister, and they came over to me, and she put her hand on my hand, and she said, I don't remember what she said. She comforted me that this was an accident, that it's a terrible, terrible accident. And it was bad enough to lose her little boy without me going down the drink. Look, I knew that. I'd done that. I've never forgotten that I'd done that. I cost him his life. And yet it was a normal accident. Kids playing in the street, they're always hit by cars or whatever. But imagine doing that and knowing that and being aware of those over there. That's a hell of a childhood.
I know you feel very defined in some way by being Jewish.
Yes.
Are you secular Jewish or are you observant?
Total secular.
Total secular.
I love being Jewish.
Uh-huh.
I love the bits of it that I love the candles. I especially love the memory of the dead, the little yahrzeit that you put out.
The candles. The candles. The 24-hour
candle.
For
24 hours, yeah. But other than that, nothing. I am not a religious person. Nor do I have any regrets. The war took care of that for me. You know, I was brought up strictly kosher, but it made no sense to me. Made no sense to me what was happening. So nothing of it means anything to me. Nothing except these few little trivial things that related to being Jewish.
Do you ever wish that you had faith?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't need it. I don't believe in that. Faith is, you know who my gods are, who I believe in fervently?
Oh.
Herman Melville, Emily Dickinson, she's probably the top. Mozart, Shakespeare, Keats. These are wonderful gods who've gotten me through the narrow straits of life.
I'm going to end on a really trivial note.
Okay. Is that all I deserve?
No, but that is what I'm going to end on, which is this. Your paintings and illustrations and glorious colors. And
thank you.
And you're wearing a gray sweater today. Do you like color on your clothes or personal adornments of color? Or is that like just totally not relevant to you?
Totally. Well, everyone who knows me complains.
Of what?
Of how drably I dress, how innocuously, stupidly, and boringly. I don't buy clothes. I don't buy clothes. I hate to buy clothes. Color on me, heavens for fans. No way. I mean, men wear pink shirts, and I'm very traditional. I'm very Brooklyn. I'm very middle class. I'm very embarrassed about the way I look. And I think if I dress sloppy and gray like I am now, that I won't be noticed. Hey, I don't have a strong self-image. And when kids say, oh, you look just like the Wild Things, that doesn't help. Just doesn't make it for me. That's not trivial. That's heartbreaking.
It's funny, too.
It's funny. Everything is funny, too.
Maurice Sendak, thank you very, very much.
Oh, well, thank you. I so enjoy being with you.
Maurice Sendak speaking with Terry Gross in 2003. A new staging of his adaptation with Tony Kushner of the children's opera Brundibar premieres Sunday in New York. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.